Taiwan surname. Do you know what Taiwan surname means? Do you know what it actually means? Taiwan surname. Is it what we as Buddhists wish each other? You know, like people say good morning, good evening, good night, and Buddhists just say Taiwan surname. Or is there more meaning to it? Is it a wish? Is it a blessing? Maybe we should try and work out what it actually means. So then when you say Theravan Sarnai to each other, you can actually say it with all your heart. Because if you knew what Theravan Sarnai meant, you'd just walk around chanting it all day long. Right, so before we do that then, let us remind ourselves of our purpose here. Let us remind ourselves of how grateful we are to be in the presence of the Noble Triple Gem, the Buddha who is our master, who is our guide, who laid down the path for us to work towards our deliverance, and the community of the Sangha, who is always there for us like a shining light, a beacon to guide us to our liberation. Let us bring our palms together in veneration of He who is the unvanquished one, the undefeated one. He who is the epitome of wisdom, the fount of compassion, the embodiment of loving kindness. Let us take a moment to pay homage to the Lord Buddha, reminding ourselves that Buddha is not just an individual, but our purpose that we are here today. Let us take refuge in the Noble Triple Gem and continue with today's proceedings. All right.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Various religions have their own belief systems. But they're all there to offer mankind solace, freedom from something. I say something because each faith, religion, belief will define this something differently. You know that in Buddhist philosophy we understand the Four Noble Truths, the noble truth of suffering. The Buddha's purpose, the Buddha's job, the Buddha's advent into the world is to free us, not just us Buddhists. If you ask him, actually, none of us are Buddhists, because he doesn't see the world as Buddhists and non-Buddhists. He sees the world as minds that need liberating. That's it. And you will soon see the world in those terms as well. So he comes into this world to help us identify the noble truth of suffering, and then he commits himself, having discovered this for himself, the cause of it, cessation of that cause, and the path to it. So that is his purpose. Some other religions might believe in a freedom where we are united with God. Their teaching will entail something along the lines of, we've come from God and we are here to serve God's purpose for us, We are here to serve God, and then if we have done our job, our duty, as He pleases, then when the day comes where our fate is decided, then we can either be reunited with God or punished for not having done so. So perhaps in those fates you will hear the words, "May God bless you." That is the blessing that they wish to have, and that is the blessing that they make one to another. Inshallah, if God wills. If this is what God wills, then may it happen. May the good Lord's blessing be with you. May God look after you. And so on. We as Buddhists, again, I don't like to say use this phrase, "we as Buddhists," because there is nothing us about Buddhists. Buddhists is not about us, it's not about you and I. It's about a mindset. Because a Buddhist does not live for 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. A Buddhist lives in a citta. In each and every citta we examine, if your effort is to free itself from the noble truth of suffering, then that is a Buddhist citta. If every citta that arises in your mind, regardless of what descent you have from your parents, if it's making an effort to free itself from something that is not noble truth of suffering, that is not a Buddhist citta. So our definition, our claim to be Buddhists have to be, or has to be, about the Four Noble Truths. That is what makes a citta a Buddhist. Nothing else, nothing more and nothing less. I'm not a Buddhist because I wear a robe. If my struggle is not to free myself from the noble truth of suffering, not just any old suffering, the noble truth of suffering, you must wonder why make that distinction? Why is it that the Buddha didn't just teach suffering? You've got to wonder, right? If you've been to the Dhammapasa, learn Buddhism at school, when you learn this, what is the Buddha's teaching? He discovered the Four Noble Truths. What were they? The first noble truth of suffering. It wasn't just the first truth of suffering. What's noble about it? Whatever it is noble about, or whatever is noble about it, we will come to learn as we progress. But it's only when your struggle, when your battle is to free your citta, your mind, from that noble definition of suffering, are you a Buddhist? So, are you Buddhists? Now it depends, Swami answer. Until this morning, oh yes. There is no Buddhist like me. I am the Buddhist, aren't I? That's my middle name. You must have thought to yourselves. And so did I. The more you learn about what being Buddhist is about, you realize actually there is no such thing called a Buddhist. There is no such person called a Buddhist. Because otherwise, you know, what is the understanding of selflessness, where there is no self, and then to say there is a Buddhist? How can the two of them coexist? It doesn't make sense. So as people of other faiths, other religions, right, they make their own blessings. We have one that we share with each other. Teruvan Sarnai. Today it is translated to English as, "May the Noble Triple Gem bless you." Yeah? And various other languages. I learn a bit of Spanish in my spare time. What for? So I can go to Spain and live a happy life one day? No, for the purpose I talked to you about last week. Que la gema triple te bendiga. It means, "May the Noble Triple Gem bless you," in Spanish. But Theruvan Sarnai. We are very familiar with that because from our very young years, formative years, we've heard at the temple, Swaminarayan says, Ahondai Puta Theruvan Sarnai. When you worship your parents, they would have blessed you with this phrase. And we've just come to use it liberally, perhaps without not fully realizing what it means. To actually help you understand what it means, I want to go back to its original version, not the "May the Noble Triple Gem bless you." Have you ever never wondered why, if the Triple Gem is so precious, why didn't they go for diamonds? Why settle for gems? Never wondered? Why settle for gems? I mean, diamonds are more precious than gems. Diamonds are more precious than gems, so why not may the triple diamonds bless you? Why gems? So the answer to that is, it was simply a translation from Ruan. Not Ruan, I don't know whether Ruan is here today. I don't mean that Ruan. Theruvan. Thunruan. Ruan is another word for Ratna. Now you must forgive me, I'm using some Sinhalese terms today, but I'll explain them to you. So, you know, it's like another language, no big deal. Ruan is another word for Ratna. And you've heard it again, Trivida Ratne. Yeah? Theruvan, Trivida Ratne. But in English we say it's the noble triple gem. The reason it's Ratna, which in Sinhalese is actually, you know, it is a word that is used for gemstones, Ratna. But Ratna has a more deeper meaning to it. Just take a moment to think about what we use Buddhism for, and then you will understand why it's Ratna. When the Buddha was asked, "Venerable Sir, how do we know that it is true, that it is your true teaching that we practice? Because today you're there for us to come and seek counsel and validate some of the things that we hear from your disciples and perhaps others who claim to be teaching exactly what you're teaching." So this question was asked of the Buddha back then, just as you would probably ask me today. Swaminarayan, how do I know that what you're teaching us, you could ask me, is true Buddhism? Because from time to time, Swaminarayan says, and lay people, you know, they'll come, you know, every, you know, throughout the year, there are various trends, aren't there? You know, some Swaminarayan says will take center stage, and then after a while, someone else will come along. After a while, another person will come along. Sometimes it might be a lay person, sometimes it might be a Silmanian Mahanse, right? And then they'll start preaching the Dhamma. And I think as members of the lay community, this is one of the problems that you have quite a lot, because I myself had the same problem. You know, from time to time people would come up and say, "This is the true teaching, so listen to this and practice this." And you'll do that for a few months until the next person comes up on your recommended on YouTube, and then you click on that. And then some Swaminarayan say would come from a foreign land, maybe from Australia or from UK or America or somewhere, and then he'll start preaching, and then you realize, well, if he's come all the way here, then, you know, he's probably got it right. So then you'll go there, you'll start listening to that. So I won't be surprised if after a few years of you being Buddhists, you're more confused than Buddhists. Confused, yes. Confused Buddhists. Don't know which one to do. Should I read the Tripitaka? Should I download it or should I buy the copy? There are 57 books. Where do I put them if I bring them home? And how much time is it going to take me to read all of it? Should I just focus on the Vinaya, or maybe should I focus on the Sutta, or should I focus on the Abhidhamma? Which one should I focus on? Because again, depending on which monk perhaps you listen to, you subscribe to, you will get a different teaching. Now, I'm going to take a sidetrack here just to answer this question because it's come up now. Because I don't want to leave you lost without an answer. Because you will come across this problem if you haven't already. Who do I subscribe to? Who do I listen to? Who do I go for advice? Whose sermons do I listen to? And no, it's not mine, in case you were wondering. Because that is not the test. It's not how well the Swami Nuhanze is able to, you know, give a good performance. I could be a monkey disguised as a monk. How do you know whether what I'm saying is true? Now you'll think, well, that is the trick. They'll always say, how do you know what I'm saying is the truth? To convince you that this is the truth. No. So what is the acid test? How do you know that what you're listening to is the real teaching? This question was asked of the Buddha back then. And the Buddha gives a very simple answer. He says, Ratna. Which Ratna? Arya Ratna? Or Vanika Ratna? No, he says Ratna. If Ratna happens within you, that is the true teaching. Now, you're only, well, what does Ratna mean then? No, it's not the gem. Yes, it is the gem today, but I'm talking about something beyond that. What is this Ratna? If the fires of desire begin to extinguish within you, if the fires of aversion begin to exterminate within you, if the fires of delusion begin to subside within you, then and only then must you be convinced that it is the Buddha's teaching that you are listening to, you are practicing, and you are following. And there is no other test. If the fires of desire, the fires of aversion, and the fires of delusion, is it you or I who knows that this is happening for you? Tell me. Whether it's happening for you or not, is it you or I who's going to know this? Of course. I can never know that. You know, perhaps you're aflame with raga, desire, and you're coming up here and say, Swaminas, I've been coming along to the sermons and I'm doing a pretty good job now. I'm really happy. Right? Maybe you put up a smile on your face. But when you get home, different story. That's why I said, you know, the true test is not about whether you can answer all the questions I'm going to give you at the end of this term. The answer is, the real test is, what do the people who live with you say about you? Because they're the people who get to see you day in, day out. What does your husband say about you? What does your wife say about you? What do your children say about you? What do your colleagues say about you? What does the dog say about you if he could? But Ratna, what is Ratna? Ratna means the cessation of a flame. It's the extinguishing of a flame. That is what Ratna means. It's to put out a fire. Ratna. The word has an etymology. Now here you'll need to rely on your understanding of Sinhalese. But if you don't, if this is just, you know, words just goes over your head, it's alright, don't worry about it. You've heard, you know, when we say something is heating up, what do we say? In Sinhalese? Ratena. And then, when you want to say you want to extinguish or exterminate something, there's another word, Nasanama. So that which helps you to extinguish or exterminate the flames or the fires, that is Ratna. So therefore we have Raga Ratna, Desha Ratna, Moha Ratna, in addition to the Arya Ratna and Vaniga Ratna. See? Trivida Ratna. Now, do you think it's still fitting to translate that as a gem? To translate the word Ratna to gem, do you think that is fitting? Personally, I don't think so, but it's what we have. It's what happened, you know, right back from when it began to be translated. In the Buddha's own instruction, he has said, do not translate my teaching, because in that translation, the essence of it will be lost. He specifically said not to translate his teaching to Sanskrit many years ago when he was around. But that was the language that was used by erudite people back then. You know, the learned, if you were learned, what was the hallmark of being learned? You knew Sanskrit. You know, the Brahmins of the time, you know, that is what to establish their standing in society. In fact, you know, they wouldn't teach it to those of a lower caste. If someone of a lower caste would be heard speaking in or using the Sanskrit language, they'd be punished. Because it was a device that was used to set in place the caste system. I'm talking about a long time ago. But then, because that was, you know, like today's English, the language of the educated, the language of the world, back then in that part of the world, it got translated to Sanskrit and then to other languages. But in those translations, the essence of it was lost. So today, you know, say if you listen to the Buddha's teaching for the first time in English, and I tell you, may the Noble Triple Gem bless you, you're not going to get the essence of it. You just think, okay, gems are precious, so it must mean that the Noble Triple Gem is precious. So the Buddha must be precious, the Dhamma must be precious, the Sangha must be precious, hence precious gems. Yes, that is not entirely wrong, but it does not encapsulate the full essence of what it means. Buddhist philosophy is Buddhist philosophy because it allows you to become a Buddhist. It helps you to become a Buddhist. It elevates you, your mindset, to a Buddhist mindset. And a Buddhist mindset is a mindset that strives to free oneself from the noble truth of suffering. Not any other suffering. It is not the suffering of fear. It is not the suffering of grief. It is not the suffering of loss. Because these sufferings, all you need to do is spend some dollars. If you have enough means and resources to yourself, right? That is what people today strive to earn as much as they can, so that when they are faced with adversity, they can soon enough recover themselves from that adversity. You know, just think about it. What does money afford you? The opportunity to recover yourself from loss with very little time, or in very little time. If you didn't have it, technology, what does technology help us do? What does money help us do? What does wealth help us do? What do we mean about when we talk about prosperity? What are we talking about? The time it takes for us to relieve ourselves from the suffering that we are all too familiar with, if that time can be reduced, we say we are a successful race. You know, think about it. In today's modern day and age, ladies and gentlemen, you know, some countries, they have nuclear weapons, don't they? Right? That's not where it started. First of all, they had catapults. First weapons. That's where they started. Knives, daggers, swords, right? And then it went on developing. Cannonballs, guns, then came along the automatic rifles, right? And then they started getting fit on ships and aircraft, in addition to the infantry. So, and then today you have the ultimate nuclear weapons. What does a nuclear weapon help you do that a catapult can't? Think about it. Then you'll realize what I mean. We are advanced as a race because today, you know, one evidence of that is we have nuclear weapons. See how advanced we are? You know, we've got enough nuclear warfare perhaps to blow up the moon. If it comes to that. And so we claim to be a developed race. We claim to be advanced in our thinking. We claim to be advanced in our technology. But think about, what is it that a nuclear weapon helps you do, obviously not you, I mean us men, do, that a catapult doesn't? A catapult, you can only shoot so far. It relies on your physical energy. And besides, you can only target one person at one time. In fact, if I had a catapult in my hand right now and I was pointing at this lady, none of you had to worry about it. But what if I had a nuclear missile and I had the button just under my fingertip? Now, not one person or two people, not a village or a city or a town, an entire nation. You can destroy and bring devastation to an entire nation at the press of a button. Advanced, right? Freedom from suffering. Don't you think so? Come on. If I don't like you, then if I have a catapult in my hand, what does that help me achieve? Freedom from? Freedom from? Suffering. Because if you are the one who brings me suffering, then my catapult helps me to free myself from suffering. If that is the same thinking that we have today, think about it. The thinking that man had many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago, when man was just so primitive, right? Let's just say by today's standards, man was very primitive. Okay, so back then, all he had was a catapult. So we say that was primitive man, primitive technology. They weren't capable of much, but what they knew was when suffering came, they picked up the weapon and shot. Bow and arrow, shot. So freedom from suffering. Today, you have nuclear missiles. Helps you do what? Freedom from suffering. If it's the same suffering they're still talking about, how tribal. What's really developed within ourselves? You've got to wonder. How have we really progressed as a race? Is this not the biggest insult to those philosophers, the thought leaders that came and went in our times? Over the last 300,000 years, you know, right from the Axial Age, if to this day and age, ladies and gentlemen, you know, when suffering comes to us, if all we know is to pick up a weapon, how tribal. What does a lion do? What does a jackal do? What does a fox do? What does a dog do when adversity comes its way? When it senses threat, what does it do? Weapon. That's why a beast has claws. With the power of its jaws and the power of its legs, what does it do? It attacks. What does man do? Advanced man of the 21st century, what does man do? Attack. Only this time he doesn't have to use his arms and his legs, but his just needs a finger, press the button, and a whole nation can be brought down to its knees, blown up into smithereens. See how advanced we are? I call it animalistic instincts. That is not very human of us. I don't think so. But think about the amount of money they spend on those things. Just developing the technology for that. I've got nothing against, you know, nations protecting themselves, safeguarding themselves against others. You know, if that's what we've come to, that's what we've come to, right? I'm not passing judgment on anyone, on any government or any state. Or, you know, this is not me speaking against nuclear missiles. Please do understand, because I have a bigger battle to fight. My fight is not with nuclear missiles. Because a nuclear missile will only kill you once. I'm fighting a battle where, because if I don't defeat my enemy, I have to die time and time and time and time again. But a nuclear missile will only kill you once. Which one's more dangerous? A nuclear missile? Or raga dvesha moha? So who do you think was the greatest freedom fighter? Who do you think came into this world to speak on behalf of all mankind? Those with the missiles and those without the missiles. Just because you have a weapon at your command doesn't mean, folks, that people are happy. In fact, those who are happy, they don't carry missiles with them. They don't carry weapons with them. Do you see a weapon on me? There's an old story. I don't know how true or false this is, but someone told me, and I like it, so I'll tell it to you. Buy it if you like. If not, full refund. It is said in his last years, Adolf Hitler, he was looking for a spiritual leader to find solace, because he was remorseful about much of what he'd done. And he wanted to look for solace, you know, in the last few years of his life. He regretted, you know, there was much repentance, and he wanted to seek something to free himself. And then it is said, so again I say, I don't know whether this true is, whether it holds any water, but as I said, I just like the story, okay? So it comes with that caveat, disclaimers. Huh? So it is said that on one occasion, he asked for someone who would give him counsel. Who do I, you know, find me a good philosopher, a religious leader who I can become a follower of? So he tasked this to one of his trusted advisors, and then after a few days he said, right, Mr. Hitler, please come with me. I have a few pictures hung up on a wall of various religious leaders, and I want you to have a look at them. You can ask me any questions that you might have about them, so that you can make your own pick. So he walked into the room. He looked at the pictures one after the other. He was inspecting them. Right? So he goes and stands in front of someone. He looks at it. He goes, interesting. He walks over to the next one. Looks at it. Very interesting. Keeps going on. And then he stops at one point. So he looks at that picture and he says, who's that guy? So this trusted advisor tells him, sir, that is the Buddha. So then Hitler responds, I like him. To which they ask, but why? What about the others? To which Hitler replies, all my life I've been carrying weapons with me. And I've been using my weapons to free myself from suffering and to keep myself happy. I realize today that someone who carries a weapon is not a happy man. All the other pictures you showed me, they've got something in their hands. Some kind of weapon, some kind of device, some kind of instrument that can potentially cause harm. But this man, he's got nothing. So, if there's any among them who's happy, it must be him because he doesn't carry a weapon. Because of course, you know, this is Hitler speaking, so he knows a thing or two about weapons. Once again, I don't know whether the story is true or not, but I just like the story. My point being, folks, today we are so advanced. We have developed ourselves, and you know, we look up to some nations out there, like the States and the Americas and, you know, developed nations, first world countries. We look at them and go, wow, you know, look at the prowess that they claim to have. The power with which they stand over and above all other nations. And then you begin to wonder why. You know, think about if you're interested in perhaps sending your children abroad, as my parents once wanted me to do. In those countries, you know, they're developed nations, they have everything. That's what it says. And that is the dream. They have everything. You can become whoever you want. If you go to America, you can become whoever you want. If you go to the United Kingdom, you can get whatever you want. It's all there. The means to acquire whatever you want is readily available. Does that mean people are happier? One of the countries that has the highest suicide rates is Japan. In terms of technology, you know, I don't think you need me to spell it out to you. If it's made in Japan, it's the best thing out there. Right? So they're a very advanced nation. But why so many people are committing suicide? Why in so many of these developed countries people resort to drugs? And, you know, the thing is, when the mind suffers, when the mind is suffering from desire, aversion and delusion, and you want a break, you just want a break, what do you do? Take a Kit Kat? When you want a break, you go sit in front of a TV, you watch Netflix, you listen to Spotify, and they're readily available. If you were to, you know, if today in our world, if they were to come up with some metric to measure how advanced and developed a country is, they'll probably look at these things, you know, does everyone have a television in their homes? These are some of the metrics that they will use. By those standards, folks, our ancestors, what were they? Prehistoric. Neanderthals. Right? By those standards, our grandfathers and their grandfathers, our great-great-grandfathers, by today's metrics, what would we have to say about them? You know, they probably won't even call them Homo sapiens. They'll say they are so primitive that they didn't even have a television. In a few years from now, it will be, you know, to be considered successful, to be considered really, you know, out there, right? To be top of the game, you have to have a 3D television at home. The number of homes that have a 3D television, those countries are the developed countries. How literate you are, that I accept. Fair enough, because you know you need to have literacy. So you can communicate with others and understand the Dhamma even. Otherwise, you know, how do you understand what I'm sharing with you today? Because you understand the language. But if it is how big a refrigerator you can afford, does every home have a refrigerator? If that is the metric of our success, so that people can come bring whatever they like with them and put it in the fridges and their freezers, so that it is always available to them whenever they need it. You know, back then, people didn't need that, all that. You know, if they had a meal that would save their hunger, that would be sufficient. Because those days, food was simply medicine for hunger. Today it's not. Would you agree? Today food is not medicine for hunger. But the Buddha himself teaches, use food only as medicine for hunger. If you want to find and achieve ultimate happiness, real happiness. Because the more you indulge in food, and the more you consider food to be your source of happiness, the more you become a slave to it. Perhaps there are those that you know who are slaves to the food. Therefore, if you walk down a supermarket aisle, you know, you only went in there for a bottle of milk and a loaf of bread, but you come out with a shopping cart full of stuff that you don't really need. Sometimes you come back home and you look at your shopping and you wonder, how the heck did that get in there? You don't know. Supermarkets these days, they're very cleverly designed by people who understand this philosophy. They don't comprehend the philosophy enough for them to go and free themselves up, but what they do understand is the psychology behind this. So what they'll do is, they'll design those places so intricately, so that when you walk into a store, there is not a snowball's chance in hell that you will walk out with just what you went in there for. That's why at the cashier, what else do they have? All those ultra-processed foods. You know, you have the chocolates and the sweets and all sorts of things. Right? Convenient. Very convenient. When you walk into a supermarket, should we go and change all this? Is that why I'm talking to you about this? Should we stand up against this? Should we fight for consumer rights? No, we've got a bigger battle to wage. We have a bigger war. The fight against raga, desha and moha. If I'm not going to stand up against nuclear missiles, I'm not going to go and stand up against supermarket aisles. Obviously. We've got bigger fish to fry, folks. Three big fish. Three big fish. The size of blue whales. They are. Now these supermarkets, you know, they've carefully designed their aisles so that the lower aisles have all these foods that children like. Next time you walk in, have a look. Why are they in the lower aisles? Of course. So that your children see them and they want them. But you went in there for a bottle of milk and a loaf of bread. Oh, speaking of which, where do they normally put the milk and the bread? Oh, God. Where do they put that? Right at the back. Why? Because you have to take the scenic tour. Are they wrong for doing this? No. Absolutely not. If any of you wish to start a supermarket, do the same. See? If you want to start a supermarket, if you are going into business to make money, you've got to make money. You're not forcing things on people. Now, you're not going to put a gun against their head and say, buy this or I'm going to shoot you dead. No. Right? If they've got free will, if they're free to choose, right, it doesn't matter where you put them, which aisle you put your bread and your milk. It doesn't matter. But people who walk into the store, they've got to be intelligent enough. Shouldn't they? Yeah. Oh, and where do they put the green stuff? The vegetables, the greens, where do they put that stuff? Right at the entrance. Do you know why? Because when you fill your supermarket, your shopping cart with that stuff, you feel good about yourself. You feel good that you're eating healthy, right? You've put your vegetables, the 5 a day, right? You've got all that in your shopping cart, right? And now you feel good about yourself. You feel virtuous. And all of a sudden a halo appears above your head. Just as a mother who walks into the supermarket, you see the vegetable, put it in your bananas, your pineapples, whatever. Put in there, now you feel, I'm a responsible mother. A what mother? I'm a responsible mother. I care about my children. See what I feed my family? Only the good stuff. So, of course, I deserve a treat. Next time you walk into the supermarket, observe these things. And then what? Go and complain to the manager? If you complain to the manager, the manager will come and complain to me. He'll tell me, if these people, they come to you every Sunday, sort them out. Don't ask them to come and sort me out. That's what they do. And if they have a bakery at the supermarket, where do they put that? Again, around the entrance. Because it has the aroma. That nice bread smell? Freshly baked bread, buns, pastries. What does that do to you? Yum, yum, yum. It gets your gastric juices flowing. Yeah? Why? Ratna. You're a victim. Victim of desire. In those moments, folks, try and even if you succumb to them, right? Do take a moment to at least remind yourself about what I've told you today, and just picture yourself where raga is a devil that's on your shoulders. He's got you by your neck, got you on the floor, and just thumping you down. At least try and picture that. And Swami Nuhansi looking at you and going, sin no. I want to free you. I want to give you freedom so that you can actually act your own will. This is not your will. This is not your will. You are slaves. Slaves to no one. Slaves to yourself. Not yourself. Yourself. The person that you think you are, that is who you are a slave to. The person that you think you are, that unique identity, you are a slave to that. Because in those moments, are you going to say that you are a Buddhist? Walking down the supermarket aisle? Huh? Tell me, why do you eat ice cream? What good does it do to you? Ask the dentist whether they would recommend ice cream. Ask your family doctor whether they would recommend ice cream. Would they? No. Doctors in the house recommend ice cream? Certainly not. It's not good for your throat. It's not good for your blood. It's not good for your body. It's not good for anything really. It's just loads of sugar, sweetened. But you can't stop yourself. So when you walk past that freezer, right? And nowadays they don't even close the damn thing, do they? Less resistance. The more obstacles they put between you and your pleasure, right? Or what seems like pleasure, the less chance of you actually going after it. That's why you don't go. That's why you don't go after the queen, the king's wife. Too many obstacles. Because if you even just look at her, right, you'll have to answer with your life. Too many obstacles. So in the supermarket, they remove all those obstacles. So much investment goes into just planning it out, designing a supermarket. It's big business, it's big money. It's a huge, massive industry, not the supermarket itself, but the designing of a supermarket. That in itself is a massive industry. So do we stand up and fight against all that? Please, let's not be fools. If that's your battle, then don't come here. That's not what we are here for. I'm here to help you free yourselves from whom? From yourselves, nobody else. That's why you should only bring yourself here. Don't bring anybody else. Ratna. Exterminating the fires of desire, aversion and delusion. This is what the Trivida Ratna does. That is what Theruvan Saranai means. What is Sarana? We understand it is refuge. Yeah? Refuge. Loose translations. It's the best we have, so we live with it. Again, I'm going to have to make use of or request you to just remind yourself of a bit of Sinhalese, for those of you who do know. What is the word for roaming? Sarisarna? Roaming? When you roam, not Italy, roam. Where the buffalo roam, and the deer and the antelope play, that roam. Roaming is saranava. Sarisaranava. And again, to exterminate or to extinguish or to cease, to stop that, nasanava. Saranasanava. Sarana. So once you exterminate desire, aversion and delusion, now you have stopped your roaming. What is roaming? Roaming in sansara. Theruvan Saranai. Do you think it's just a greeting? Like good morning? See how profound these things are? You know, these are this is our inheritance from the fully awakened one. We must not underestimate this. He's the all-knowing one. He's the omniscient one. So it's not your family doctor who gave this. It's not your science teacher or your history teacher who taught you this. This is the Lord Buddha. And when the Buddha says something, we've got to take a moment to think once, twice, and again, because there's more than what meets the eye, more than just the superficial meanings behind all of these things. They have such profound and deep meaning, and they must all relate to Nibbana. Now do you see how Theruvan Saranai relates to Nibbana? Because what is the Buddha's purpose into this world? If not Nibbana, nothing else. Nahi silena vatang hotu. The Buddha's purpose is not to teach us about rites and rituals and practices and observances. He's not come into this world to give you the 5 precepts, observe it and now you're Buddhist. That is not his purpose. He's come to this world. His coming into this world was to help us realize the 4 Noble Truths. Once you realize the 4 Noble Truths and you have fulfilled the 4 Noble Truths, then you will have attained Nibbana. The moment you see and realize the Noble Truths for the first time, when you get that glimpse of it for the first time, that is when you will have become a Sotapanna, a stream enterer. This stream ends in the ocean of Nibbana, hence stream enterer. And like a stream, once you get into the stream, you don't have to swim. The stream will carry you. That is why it is a fitting analogy. You don't have to struggle to get to the ocean, right? Because all streams flow where? Uphill? No, they all flow to the ocean. So even if you don't make extra effort, even if you don't, you know, go the whole 9 yards, the full bells and whistles, even if all you do is remain in the stream, gradually the stream will take you to the ocean. That is why in the Noble Eightfold Path, ladies and gentlemen, Sammaditti is the only thing you need to come to. The rest of it happens. It's not something you need to do technically. You don't need to do Samma Sankappa. And I'll prove it to you. Take Samma Vacha for instance. Right speech. Again, translations, that's the biggest disservice that has happened to the sasana. But it's the best we have. Samma Vacha is not right speech. Because when we think about right, not wrong, right. The word Samma has much deeper meaning than that. Ignorance and attachment, their combination is Sang. When ignorance and attachment come together to cause mayhem, to wreak havoc, that's when we call sangha. In fact, any combination, we have a prefix in Sinhalese, don't we? Sangha. What is music? Sangha? Geeta. Why so? It is a combination coming together of notes, bits of music to make a song. See? What is combination in Sinhalese? Sangha? Sangbandha or Sangyojana. See? Wherever you use the word sangha, it implies a coming together. It implies a combination. It implies a unison. What about ma then? Not ma then, but ma. Sangma. You know this because when you are at the end of a meritorious deed, or what, like an almsgiving or at the temple, right? We have this gatha, which you are all very familiar with. You chant it, but you may not know the meaning behind it. When you seek forgiveness for any trespassings, transgressions, right, any wrongdoings, what is the gatha that you recite? Kayana vacha, chittena. Sorry, not that one. When you make a resolve, right? So after you've done your merits and you resolve for those merits to help you to dissociate from ignoble association, right? To refrain and to dissociate yourself from ignoble association and to be in the companionship of noble friends. What is the gatha for that? Imina punyakamena mame bala samagamo satan samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Until Nibbana, may I, by the power of these merits, be able to dissociate myself or disassociate with ignoble friends and associate with noble friends. Ma me bala samagamu. Ma. From whom? Bala samagamu. What is bala samagamu? Ignoble friends. In other words, bad friends. In other words, those who speak to you, who encourage you, who entice you to engage in worldly doings and therefore further your journey in samsara. Because they have no understanding of the truth. They don't understand the Four Noble Truths. Because their view is not Samma Ditti, their view is Michcha Ditti. So they'll talk to you about how wonderful the food is. They'll talk about how lovely the music is. They'll talk about how beautiful the sight is. And every time they speak to you about this, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, now I know, you're probably wondering, but come on, Swami Nahansa. Isn't that just the way we live our lives? Isn't this normal? You know, if we as good Buddhists, we don't kill, we don't steal, we don't engage in sensual, sexual misconduct, you know, we don't lie, you know, is it so bad to enjoy the world around us? Well, the truth is this, ladies and gentlemen. You're thinking like this right now because you haven't understood the Four Noble Truths yet. Because you think suffering is only when you do bad things. Right now, or yet at least, you haven't understood the suffering of when you are happy. You think there is suffering when you are suffering, and you are happy when you are happy. So you see the world as two halves. Right? When I'm suffering, I'm suffering. What are examples of suffering? When I'm at a loss. When I'm grieving. When I'm in sorrow. Right? When one of my loved ones pass away. When I fail my exam. When I don't get the promotion. When I get demoted. When I get depressed. When I'm stressed, anxious. These are the times when I suffer. But then there are the good times. When I'm with my friends. When I'm at the games. When I'm watching the movie. When I'm eating good food. When I'm with my spouse, when I'm with my family, these are the good times. So therefore, these are the good times and these are the bad times. All we have to try and do is get rid of the bad ones. That doesn't make you a Buddhist because everyone in the world does that. You can't tell me that that is the noble truth of suffering. That is suffering, I admit, but it can't be the noble truth of suffering, because if it was the noble truth of suffering, you don't need the Buddha to come and teach you that. Don't we all know that when we are at a loss, we suffer? When we fail an exam, right, it bothers us? When we are afraid, when we are scared of the dark, whatever. Right? That can't be the suffering that the Buddha taught. Because everyone knows that. In case, if that is so, why did the Buddha come into this world having preached the Dhamma and then went on to say, you know, in this world of devas and maras and humans, there is no one who has seen this Dhamma, this teaching before I did. So I have not listened to this from somebody else. I have not learnt it from somebody else. This is the first time that this teaching is proclaimed, and it can only be done by a supreme Buddha. And once I have turned this wheel into motion, it cannot be stopped again. It cannot be reversed. Why did the Buddha say so? Was he lying? So he must have seen a suffering that goes beyond and transcends the everyday suffering we are talking about. It is not the same, folks. I need you to understand this. Not for my behalf, on yours. I need you to understand this. So then when we live a happy life, whatever our definition of a happy life is, go to the park, you know, go for a swim, go to the gym, have a nice weekend, long weekends come along every once in a while, New Year comes along once in a while, then a family get together, right, rejoice, be happy. Yes, you know, in a lay life, of course, you know, you get to enjoy that. I'm not saying let all that go. That's certainly not what I'm saying. Because in those moments, you know, you're happy, and that's good. I like for you to be happy. But what I'm saying is, what I need you to do is one step at a time, gradually. If you realize this just before your death, on your deathbed, so be it. That's fine. There's no rush. But I need you to realize the truth. The truth that the Buddha speaks of, the suffering, the noble truth of suffering that the Buddha speaks of, is not the day-to-day suffering that we are all so accustomed to. That is not the suffering. If so, don't you think that the beasts in the four great hells would understand suffering more than anybody else? Because all they do is suffer. They don't even have a moment of joy or bliss. What about poor people? People who can't afford a square meal. People who can't afford clothes, no education, they can't even afford a home. If they go through suffering more than you and I do, right, then shouldn't they understand suffering better than you and I do? So then that can't be suffering. They are suffering, but they haven't understood suffering. They are two different things. So Ratna, Raga, Dvesha and Moha, these are the fires that keep you in flames. And if you can exterminate them, now, Ragakhe, Dveshakhe, Mohakhe. Ragakhe, Dveshakhe, Mohakhe, Nibbana. This is the Buddha's words. When asked, what do you mean by Nibbana, Venerable Sir, the Buddha replies, Ragakhe, Dveshakhe, Mohakhe, Nibbana. He gives this because it's the perfect yardstick for us to measure whether we are on that journey. Because like I said, how much raga, dvesha and moha you have left within you is not a question you can ask me, can you? I would never be able to answer that question. The Buddha would perhaps. Not perhaps, he certainly would, because he has a special skill, a special knowledge. It's called the asayanusayana. He can scan you like an x-ray machine and tell you how much raga, dvesha and moha are left within you and exactly what you need to do to free yourself from that. Oh well, we missed that boat. But not all is lost, because we still have the Dhamma laid down clearly, crystal clear. So how do you know that you're progressing on the Dhamma? Is the extinguishing of raga happening within you? This is the question you have to ask yourself. Are you feeling you are freed from aversion and delusion? Are you sensing that freedom? Are you sensing liberation? It is not you elevating. No lights flying out of your head. None of those things. You know, nothing supernatural here. This is all very normal stuff. You know, this Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen, is for human beings like you and I. It is for all sentient beings. You don't have to be special to attain Nibbana. I'm not special. I'm a very normal human being. If you cut me, I'll bleed the same as if you cut yourself. I'm a very normal human being. The Dhamma is for normal human beings. In fact, the more you are grounded in reality, the better this will make sense to you. If you are a down-to-earth person, the better this will make sense to you. If you are a practical person, right? If you are pragmatic in your approach to things, the better this will make sense to you. So live a full life. I don't expect you to stop anything you do besides any unmeritorious deeds. Any sins, any of the 10 sins, the 10 unmeritorious deeds, if you're doing any of them, stop it immediately. Not when you're ready, stop it now. That might even come across as an insult. You probably think, we don't do those things. Sometimes you may do it without knowing it. How many times when you're at the workplace, do you go home, just picking up maybe a pen, some stationery from the workplace and take it home? Because you think you're entitled to it. If this has ever happened to you, think about it. You know, I work at the office. This is my pen. It's been given to me to do my work. So what's so wrong with me taking it home and giving it to my 6-year-old? Oh, the printer has run out of paper. The wife just rings. Printer's run out of paper. Can you get some paper on your way home, honey? Oh, yeah, sure. There's a printing machine just around the corner. You walk up to the printing machine and there's a bundle of A4. Not much, just 20 sheets of paper. Just enough to fit in your briefcase. You put it in the bag, take it home, what's the deal? You know, if you'd done a report, you would have had to print it anyway. So, you know, you were the one who was going to print it. So, you know, justification. And you might wonder, is that such a sin? Is that a sin? That's a sin on a grand scale. Because when you do that, you haven't stolen from one person. You've stolen from the entire company. Now imagine if you work in the public sector. Good luck to you. If you walk home with just as much as a paperclip, it's there to do your job, not to go and give it to your 6-year-old. The company paid for it. The organization paid for it. The taxpayer paid for it. The country pays for it. It's there so you can file that report and submit it so that some good can come to your country, to your nation, to your whatever. And you take that home with you. You know you're taking it home. You just don't know it's theft. That matters not. You don't need to know what you're doing is theft for it to be theft. You just need to know that you're taking something that doesn't belong to you. Now if you take a walk back memory lane, you're thinking, I shouldn't have come this morning. That's exactly what I realized when I first heard this. All the sins that we've committed without even knowing that they were sins. If you have an official vehicle that has been given to you for official purposes, traveling from place to place to do your business, either in your private company or in our state vehicle. If you drive that around without permission, where it has not been approved to do so, for personal use, if you use it for your personal trips, now who do you think you're stealing from? 20 million taxpayers. Not one person. Yes, work in the public sector comes with its pros, but it also comes with its cons, if you're not careful. Because, you know, the way, this is how it works, Lord Chinmay, right? The bigger the size, the bigger the virtue of the thing you're dealing with, the more careful you've got to be. That's why you should be very careful when you deal with your parents. Because they're as big can get. When it comes to you and your parents, it can't get any bigger than that. Slapping your friend and slapping your mother are not the same. Incomparable. That is why when you deal with an arahant, you've got to be very careful. That is not to say don't deal with them. Because they are the blessing, they are the salt of the earth. If you don't deal with them, who do you deal with? But like a knife, which you can use to both slice a loaf of bread as well as to slice your neck, if you don't use it carefully, you can cause much harm to yourself. This is why we need to learn and understand about these things. This is a natural phenomenon. I'm not making any of this stuff up. It is true. Because it makes sense. It is logical. Not just because it's a theory. You know, I'm not a monk. I'm a scientist in a robe. I don't take anything at face value. So, you know, at your workplace, folks, you know, if you have come into the habit of, you know, maybe using your phone for purposes that are not work-related, if you know your workers, perhaps, you know, your subordinates, your staff who do these things, if you care about them, enlighten them. Share with them this teaching. Make way for that, so that the people who work so hard for your organization, to make your organization successful, don't, unbeknown to them, commit sins that they will one day have to repay. Because, you know, they don't realize that they're thieving. They don't realize it's theft. They care about the company, they care about the organization, they care about you. But they don't know this, so therefore, they do that. But if you find yourself ever picking up your phone, making phone calls, and the company has to pay the bill, but these are personal calls, and you have not, it has not been approved for you to make personal calls. If it's approved, fair enough. It's part of the package. But if it's not approved, I tell you, don't. Whether you think of it in those terms or not, it is theft. And all that mileage that you drive around and then you put it as official trips, don't do that. If you do, sorry, I don't mean to be insulting. I just want to save you, that's all. You know, when I say these things, I don't want any of you to feel offended, okay? I don't intend to offend. I can come here and tell you a fairy tale about Tinkerbell and Peter Pan, but I don't think that's what you want from me. I think you want me to save you from your misery, from the pitfalls that you don't spot yourselves. That is what our teachers do for us as well. Our forefathers, you know, the Buddha, you know, that is what they did. The pitfalls that we didn't see, but we always kept falling into, because we were blind. A man doesn't go and jump into a pit if he can see. You know, they do that because they fall because they're blind. So we need those who have seen the light to awaken us to the truth. And of course, teach your children as well. I always talk about children. Right? Because if they don't know these things, if they don't learn these things, they will also start committing sins. And they will accumulate. As water fills into a pot, one drop at a time. But there comes a day where the water fills up to the brim. And then it overflows. In the same manner, the demerit that is committed will fill the pot one drop at a time, however big, however small. And then one day it's going to fill up to the brim. And then the next drop, like the last straw that breaks the camel's back, that next drop will overflow the pot. And when that happens, you will have hell to answer. But these are things that people do without knowing them. You know, I know that none of you actually would do it if you knew it. Right? But if it's ever happened to you in the past, as it did in my past, I didn't realize until my teacher taught it to me. And then that was it, immediately stopped. Because I didn't want to commit sins. But sometimes in life, you know, you find yourselves in these predicaments where you have no other choice. You know, if you have a rat infestation at home, what do you do? Build another room for them? What do? If you have a cockroach infestation in your kitchen, what do? If the ants decide that it's time that they took over and sent you off, what do? You know, in this world, in this human world, ladies and gentlemen, kallasukkam kallasukka vipakam. Your hands are tied. In vain you got yourselves here. I don't mean here. I mean as humans into this world. Because now that you live and you have to survive and you have to keep, you know, you have to keep yourself sane, there will be things that you will have to do. And please don't come and ask me, what should I do? I know some of you will come and ask me later on, Swami, no, there's a rat infestation, now what do I do? No, you're not going to get answers from me for that. I'll tell you what to do. Ratna. Here's the answer. So don't come asking me again. Ratna. Work on eradicating desire, aversion and delusion. So that you don't have to be born as humans again. So you don't have to be born again. Because as long as you're here, right? As long as you're here, you have to do what you have to do to survive. You know, if you have rowdy neighbors, noisy neighbors, right? They'll tell you, you go and speak to them once, you speak to them twice, you speak to them a third time, right? But they're just messing about, making so much noise and just making life hell for you. What do you do after that? Don't ask me. If you do, you're only going to get the same answer. You know, like the Makkah story, I'm always going to keep coming back to that. Ratna. Now you've got to realize, why did I choose a life as a monk? Because I have come to realize, folks, that the only way you can win this is to accept defeat. Should I say that again? It kind of makes no sense. It's such an ironical statement. It's a paradox. The only way to win this is to accept defeat. Those who accept defeat are victorious. Those who keep on fighting. Today, they have nuclear missiles at their command, but they are still unhappy. They started with the catapult, bow and arrow, knives and daggers and swords, rifles and cannonballs. And today they have nuclear missiles. You know, in the future, they'll fight with planets. Right? There's my planet, that's your planet. They'll catapult planets against each other. That's what they do when they start fighting with the aliens. Don't be surprised. Because technology will be so advanced, you know, they'll fit whatever devices that they need to move planets here and there so that they can steal planets from each other. The mind cannot be satisfied until you plug that hole in your vessel. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Remember the pot that cannot be filled? Remember that? The mind that cannot be satisfied no matter how many movies you watch? The mind that cannot be satisfied no matter how many songs you listen to? The mind that cannot be satisfied no matter how many places you go to? How many sights you see, how many sounds you listen to, how many tastes you experience? The mind cannot be satisfied. It's uncontent. It cannot be contented because you're trying to fill a pot that has a hole in it. Ratna helps you to mend that hole. Helps you to mend the pot. That's what Ratna does. The eradication of raga, eradication of dvesha, eradication of moha. And for that, you need the Four Noble Truths. So, whenever you wish someone Theruvan Sarnai, even if the recipient of your wish, of your blessing, may not understand it, now you can do it meaningfully. Really what you're saying is, may you attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. May you realize the noble truths. May you be freed of raga, dvesha and moha. This is the wishing, this is the blessing that you give. And tell me about what you give. What happens to it? What you give is what you get. So when in your heart, when in your mind, you're always wishing good and greatness unto others. When your heart is when your heart is benevolent, always wishing Nibbana to others. If that is what you keep giving, that is what you will keep getting back. So whenever you wish Theruvan Sarnai, I mean, you know, I encourage you to start it at home. That's where charity has to start. Start it at home. I had a habit from my very young years, before I went off to school, I would worship my parents, and that remained until the last day. Even when I started work, I used to do that. My parents didn't know to say Theruvan Sarnai. But they touched my head, kissed my forehead, and said, just, you know, see you soon. Because my parents didn't know this. But you parents, now you do. What more, what is a greater blessing than the blessing of ultimate bliss? So I encourage you to start doing it at home. Start at home. You know, if your children are still young enough that they are willing and prepared to listen to what you have to say, well, I have to say that as well. There comes a point where, you know, they become the boss. It's your time to listen to them, right? But if they are still prepared to listen to you, if they are still in their hearts, if they are still children and you are still parents, then they will be willing to do that. Do it on their behalf, not on yours. Remember the other day I told you about this. The reason that you got to get your children to worship you is not so that you can be happy. My parents, my children are also worshipping me now. That is not why you should be doing it. You should be doing it on their behalf. Because when they do that, they earn lots of merit. One of these days I'll explain to you what a worship really means. Not today, another day. Although we just simply think of worshipping as getting on our knees and bringing our hands together, and it, you know, it seems like a mark of respect of some sort. Why do you have? Why can't you just do a somersault? Why do we do it that way? Why don't we just salute? That's also a, you know, a way of showing respect. Huh? But why do we do it that way? Why is it in our culture, you know, in our tradition, why do we do it that way? Everything has a meaning, folks. None of the things that have passed down to us from our ancestors were done so-so. Everything had meaning. That's why I said last week, you know, we are Sri Lanka because this was where the Sri Sambuddha Sasana prevailed. We borrowed Sri from Sambuddha Sasana as a nation. Without the Buddha Sasana, this is no longer Sri Lanka. It's just Lanka. Sri comes from the Buddha Sasana. Sri Sambuddha Sasana. Because our ancestors, they had plenty of time on their hands. Because, you know, they didn't want to defend themselves from each other because they knew to defend themselves from Ratna. From Raga, Desha, Moha. They committed their lives to that. Their interest was not in building sky rises. Their interest was not in, you know, entertaining themselves. Certainly they had their limits, but today we are limitless because the whole world has been open to us. We are globalized and rapidly. It keeps on going. And unfortunately, there's no limit because the mind can never be satisfied. So in 50 years from now, what do you think the world will look like? Like it looks today? Do you think so? No. You know, back then, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was considered obscene on television to be showing a woman with her leg exposed, just her leg. You know, maybe if it was just over the knee, that was considered obscene 10 years ago. Today, I don't need to tell you, do I? I can't tell you because I don't watch TV, but I'm sure you will know. So one might ask, is that so wrong? That's fashion. Well, if fashion is how little you dress, then the most fashionable things are the animals in the zoo. They're very fashionable. They hardly have a thread on their bodies. No, there's a reason why people used to cover themselves up. There's a reason for that. Because they realize that in a man's mind, the object that is of the greatest desire, in the Buddha's own words, is the figure of a woman. And in a woman's mind, or at least a mind that thinks that they are a woman, that's the way now we've got to understand it. Right? Because you are neither man nor woman, but your mind thinks you are. So in a woman's mind, the object of greatest desire is that of a woman, typically. And people knew this. So therefore, what they wanted to do was to do as much as they could, or in other words, do as little as they could, to ignite desire in another person's mind because they had compassion towards them. It was all done out of compassion. They realized, you know, to ignite the flame of desire in another man's mind, or a woman's mind, you know, that is the worst thing you could do for them, you to them. It's worse than stealing from them, because if you steal from someone, they can go and, you know, somehow find a way to get it back. But if you ignite the fire of desire, they have to live with it until the end of samsara. Truth be told, ladies and gentlemen, if I were to come up to you and say that this is nice, it's lovely, and if you accept my word, you have to come across the Buddha before you let go of that idea. Any man, woman, or child, any man or beast could come up to you and say that something's good, because this is miccha ditti. Something's pleasurable. That pleasure is to be found in this. I could say that to you. Anyone could say that to you. But then for you to come out of that miccha ditti and into samma ditti, you need the Buddha. That is how rare it is for someone to be saved from wrong view once it settles in the mind. But people knew this. People realized this. So they used to cover themselves up because they didn't want other people, out of compassion. They didn't want other people to suffer from desire. I mean, it doesn't take much to think and realize that in today's day and age, people do suffer, don't they? Why is pornography such a big industry? Is it because fashion is just fashion? Once again, I've got nothing against fashion. I've got nothing against anything. The only thing I've got something against is desire, aversion, and delusion. Nothing else. I don't like you being slaves to desire, aversion, and delusion. Bring me a prostitute and I'll talk to her. That's fine. Because I want to save her from prostitution. I want to talk to her and help her realize that desire, aversion, and delusion are killing her before it kills somebody else. I don't hate the sinner. I only hate the sin. I love the sinner. Because there is no bad person out there. There's no such thing as a bad man or a bad woman. People are not bad. It's the defilements that are bad. That's why you can't make me angry. You can't disappoint me. Because I know even if you did all the things that I didn't want you to do, you're doing it not because you are bad. It's because your mind is defiled. When you're ill, what you know, if, say your son fell ill, right? They're coughing, spewing blood, diarrhea, right? What do you do to the child? Kill it? What do you do? Take it to the doctor, diagnosed, find the disease, right? If it's a bacteria, a virus, treat it. So you kill only the sin, not the sinner, right? In the same way, right? When I see people either angry, furious, hurting other people, waging war, or preparing that nuclear missile that is readily available to them to press at the drop of a hat, whatever the case might be. Or that poor man on the bus who can't control himself so that he goes and leans against another woman and soon enough ends with a black eye. People hit him. They hit the sinner because they don't understand. And in doing so, they earn demerit again. See, the sin keeps on passing. That's why it's such a bad deal. Never get yourself there. Don't be the guy who punishes the bad guy. Because when you do that, you become the bad guy. It's not up to us to inflict punishment, to pass judgment. Let God look after that. In other words, let karma sort that out. Go back to your younger years, you know, perhaps you've seen on cartoons and so on, right? A snake, a serpent, right? Catches a rabbit. What did we learn we had to do in those moments? The innocent rabbit, the poor little thing. But the serpent, this evil serpent, has now caught a rabbit. A rabbit, this poor little thing, a rabbit. What must you do in that time? If you are there and you had a rock or a stick in your hand, what are you supposed to do? Save the rabbit, right? Save the rabbit. Because innocent thing, you know. But what about the serpent? No, kill the bugger. Serpent? No. Kill the bugger. Rabbit? Save it. Who let you decide that? What's going on is the reconciliation of a samsaric transaction. A samsaric transaction being reconciled. This is tit for tat. It's not for us to get involved. It's for us to sit aside, look at it, observe, and realize, me next. Shocking, huh? You never thought you'd hear this. So if someone's beating someone up, what should you do? Run away? No, I don't say that. Do you remember the story where once the Buddha walked up to a boy, a group of boys, young guys? They were beating up, actually they were attacking a serpent. Right? And the Buddha said, stop that. Don't do that. In some textbooks, in fact, what we've come to learn today is that the Buddha was so compassionate towards the animal, he was trying to save the animal. That is not what the Buddha was doing. Because the Buddha comes into this world to help people realize the four noble truths, not suffering. The Buddha knows that if not for this guy, some other guy is going to come and beat the hell out of that snake. Death is going to come to all of us eventually. So whether you die today or tomorrow, what difference does it make? But what the Buddha realized was, these guys, these young boys, they're attacking this animal, and in doing so, earning demerit. The animal can't understand what I have to say, but the boys can. So if I speak to them and get them to stop doing this demeritorious deed, then perhaps I can preach to them, and they'll understand the Dhamma, and they'll free themselves. Because if they don't stop this now, one day it'll be tit for tat. The tables will turn. The beater always gets beaten up. The attacker always gets attacked. What you give is what you get. That is what the Buddha did. So if you see a quarrel, if you see an argument, if you see an altercation, and you want to get involved, don't be the one who inflicts punishment on the person who has been inflicting punishment so far. Don't be nature's executioner. That's not your job. You know what an executioner is, right? Capital punishment, yeah? Don't be nature's executioner. Let nature take its course. Your job is to stand aside, observe what's going on. If you can speak to them, try and settle it. But, you know, there's only one refuge. That is what you have come here for. Because in the heat of the moment, ladies and gentlemen, you know, one way or the other, it's going to sort itself out. Yes, of course, you know, perhaps you can go in there, settle them down. You know, let's not do this. You know, come on, you know, sort it out. There's no need to have a fight, right? Yes, you will be the good Samaritan. Agreed. Good. Hats off to you. But what if, you know, they throw their arms and legs around and you get hit? If you are not tamed enough to control yourself, I've seen this happen plenty of times. I went to school as well, you know. And then the question becomes, why did you hit me? I didn't hit you. I only came to settle the argument. Why did you hit me? And then they hit back. And now what does it become? One becomes two, two becomes four, and then it just keeps on growing. You know, the long and short of all this is, I am certainly not here to fix the world. I'm only here to fix those who wish to be fixed. I ask you, what is it that you want to do? Do you want to fix the whole world? Be my guest. Go do it. If you want to fix yourself, and while you're fixing yourself, do whatever you can to help others. You know, and this is what I'm doing right now. I'm fixing myself, and as I'm doing that, I'm helping you fix yourselves. I'm not encouraging you to go and fix others. As in, without looking after yourself, if you go, just go and keep sorting other people out. You know, trying to stop world wars, trying to stop hunger, trying to stop this, that, and the other. That is not the answer, folks. You can't help someone else if you're not helped yourself. Sort yourselves out. Do that for yourself. And, you know, in whatever command you have, perhaps, you know, for you at home you have your children, do it with them. Do it with your spouse. Do it with your closest friends. Because you can only reach so far. And that's fine. Reach as far as you can. But first and foremost, you need to sort yourself out. I was talking about the way we used to dress back then. And then I got carried away into something else. I remember on TV 10 years ago, what was considered obscene is today just, you know, that's fashion. But those days people realized that when you expose yourselves in ways that ignites desire in other people's minds, what you're doing is actually something contradictory to accepted norms, culture, and so on. Because, you know, a society can only exist for as long as it has the culture that keeps it bound together. Every society has its own culture. So one is not right and the other is wrong. Right? There's a Western culture, there's an Eastern culture, there's our culture. Right? But these are the values, the norms that keep our society bound together. The relationships that we have with our parents, with our elders, with our teachers, all of this goes into making who we are. It is how this, you know, this fabric of society is woven and kept together. And we need to respect that. That is why what is right in Western culture is not going to be right here. But when we start importing everything without any concern or consideration for what is right on this land, where the Buddha Sasana prevails, then terrible things will start to happen soon enough. Today people invest a lot of money and effort into trying to figure out, you know, what is the treatment for cancer. A lot of research going into cancer. What people don't realize is, cancer is our own making. We make our own cancer. Just think for take a moment to think about, you know, what are some of the areas in which people are more prone to have those tumors which go on to become cancer? Usually there are these areas where you are supposed to cover yourselves up. Mouth, chest, other parts of the body. They are more prevalent than others. When you take actions that disrupt the very fabric of society, cultures, norms and values, those actions have their own karma. And that karma comes back as vipaka. So, in this life, yes, they may have lived holy lives. But if you go back and find out the cause of it, all the way back, you'll realize that all of this, you know, people get cancers because of being a cancer to society. You know, we have a saying, right? You know, that's a cancer to society. You know, this person's behavior, these traits, are, you know, they're a cancer to society. We use that word in that sense. It means something that is destructive. And it's not just destructs and disrupts in one place, but keeps on growing. Pervasively destructive. That is the nature of a cancer. So when people, through their actions, become a cancer to society, if that is what they give, that is what they get. So what am I giving you right now? The treatment for cancer. Trividaratna. Raga, particularly. Dvesha, not so much, but moha. Raga, dvesha and moha. When those fires ignite, and you do things to ignite those fires in others, now you are being a cancer to society. Because when people, they soon stop realizing that this is my mother, this is my sister, this is my daughter. Remember last week I told you about how people now share pictures of their siblings, their beloved sisters on the internet? You know, just because they want some pocket money? I mean, how could someone stoop to such a low level? This is the nature of the mind. It's not because they're bad, that's what raga does. Natthi rago samanaggi, the Buddha says. There is no fire like the fire of raga. And there's a reason why the Buddha uses this metaphor. It is because, ladies and gentlemen, a fire does not stop until it has consumed everything in its way. That's why the Buddha uses this analogy. Think about a wildfire. If it starts, it'll consume the entire forest before it'll stop, right? Because the fire keeps on growing. That's why you will have heard of people who, because of their fury, right, they get so enraged that they drop unconscious. But have you heard of anyone who fell unconscious because they were so lustful? They felt so much lust within them that they dropped unconscious. Ever heard of that? That doesn't happen. Because dvesha has its limits. You can't go beyond that. Your body switches off. Your mind cannot control it. So you go unconscious. People, you know, they get really angry, they become unconscious. When the body can't sustain that the heat of it. But desire is not the same. And the reason for that is because alongside the fire of desire, you have pleasure. You experience the pleasure of desire. This is what keeps you going from one to the other, to the other, to the other. Someone told me recently, back then when pornography first came, right? Apparently on those sites there were, you know, just things by today's standards you might think, you know, is that actually porn? By today's standards you might think that. Right? Maybe just, you know, someone who was half naked. Apparently that was porn back then. But today, apparently there's a genre called incest. Relationships in the family. Mothers with their sons. Fathers with their daughters. See what the internet has gifted us? This is all drushti. Sit your kid in front of the internet for half an hour. They sit for a whole day with their friend at school, right? And then they come home, sit for half an hour in front of the internet. All they got to do is turn on incognito mode. And nowadays, you know, VPNs and all these things, you know, children are way ahead of you people. You'll need to start installing firewalls in your homes soon enough. And then they open up the browser and you're recommended. This is what is hot these days. In every sense of the word hot. This is what is hot these days. This is what people are watching these days. This is the new trend. What's the new trend? Incest. Of course, you know, the people who are acting there, they're not mothers and sons. They're not fathers and daughters. They're actors. But look at the drushti that they give to a young child watching that. And they watch that and they begin to think, well, if apparently, you know, being with someone in the family is so delightful, perhaps this is how all drushti comes. Think about the last time you went shopping for something. Like, the only way that drushti comes to you is from the outside. Either something you hear or something you see. There is no other way that drushti comes to you. Why are you here today? Because someone said, there's a nice sermon on a Sunday morning, come along. See, someone said that. That drushti brought you here. The drushti is a view, what you hold as true, your worldview. It is influenced by everything that comes through your ears and everything that comes through your eyes. That is a drushti. Samma drushti the same, mitya drushti the same. But sit that kid in front of a computer. Innocent child doesn't know right from wrong. Parents are far too busy to look after him and be with him. Spend quality time with them because they leave at 4 o'clock in the morning and they come back at 10 o'clock at night. Because they are far too busy earning so that they can give the children a good education. Send them to Australia, to a good university, so that they can go on to become successful people in this world. Jesus. Folks, this is a cancer. That child will watch that, and they, by watching, will come to learn about incest. There is no other way they're going to learn that. They're going to learn that by watching about it. And then here's what they're going to do next. I know this because people who do this, young children, they come up to us and talk to us. You know, there are about 100 young children at the monastery today, ladies and gentlemen, and we talk with every one of them. They all have a story. Their parents don't know the foggiest. They haven't got the foggiest idea about the things that the kids have gotten up to. They think my child is a saint, just like perhaps you think yours is. Bring them to me and I'll tell you what they are. It is not because children are bad. They're innocent. They're just minds. And a mind is indoctrinated by the influences it gets from the outside. You are the company you keep, right? Show me the 5 people you associate and I'll tell you who you are. I don't need to even speak to you. If you want me to tell you who you are, step aside and send the 5 people you spend the most of your time with and I'll tell you who you are. Now in the same way, send the 5 people your child spends the most time with. Don't tell me it's me, Swaminas, because you are not at home to be with them. You don't have the time to be with them. You don't have the time to sit down and ask them, how was school today, Kuta? Though, what happened at school? Your best friend, what is she up to? Where does she come from? Show me your phone. Oh, you can't ask them for their phones these days. Personal space. Personal. personal space with your parents? Right. Are you kidding me? I ask you a question, folks. Should parents knock on the door before they enter the room of their children? You answer your own question. You answer that question. I don't know. If I had children and they demanded that I knock on the door before I entered the room, I'd kick them out. Then go and find your own home. It is my duty to look after my children. It is my duty to bring them up. So it is my duty to catch them red-handed so that I can fix them, not punish them. Because if I don't punish them, society will. And when society does it, they don't do it with metta, karuna, mudita and upeksha. No satara brahma viharana then. So that child sits in front of the computer, watches all this. I'll tell you a story. One child who came to us to become an anagarika. He was 13 when he came. He wanted to become an anagarika. We only take at the age of 14. But he came then. He was talking about some of the problems that he has. He says, Swaminathan, please, can you take me? My parents don't know what I get up to. So I asked him, what sort of things do you get up to? But don't worry, I won't tell them. Tell me so I can fix you now that you're here with us. This child, he's got to learn about the internet at school and learn about pornography and all that. So he's gone on these porn sites a good few times. And then he's come across this thing called incest, all on the internet. And then he'd been talking about it with his friends at school. And the friends had asked him, I don't know, should I? The friends had asked him to record his mum and dad. He'd planned for it, and he'd done it. The parents don't know anything about this. I mean, how could you tell your mother? So they got it all on, he'd gotten it all on camera. Now, you know, the child has a smartphone. Great, very smart of the parents. So can your children live without a smartphone? I don't have the answer, folks. I don't have the answer to that. My ask of you is not to take everything away from your child. My ask is to give your children something you haven't given them yet. That is the answer. You can't take drugs away from your child. You can't take sex away from your child. You can't take pornography away from your child. You can't take a smartphone away from your child. You can't take the internet away from your child. Because they need those things today to survive. It has become part and parcel of their lives. But what I ask of you is to give them something you haven't given them yet. You've given them a good education. You've given them half your property. You've given them a good future. You've given them places where they can go and become whatever they like and do whatever they want to do. Have you given them the Dhamma? Have you given them Triratna? The medicine that heals, that extinguishes and exterminates desire, aversion and delusion. If you give them this, you don't need to take anything back. How's that for a deal? If you don't give them this, you will always have to keep a watchful eye over them. You will always have to do that. So this child, he'd gotten it on his camera, on his smartphone, and he'd taken it to school and shown it to his friends. You know what the friends are like when they see something like this? Someone snatched the phone from him when he was out for lunch, and then now they've got a copy of it. You know what comes next? Blackmail. So next time you give your child lunch money and he asks for extra 200 rupees, maybe ask him why. Perhaps that's the blackmail money. So now when he goes to school, those guys who took the phone off him, they've got the video. Give me your money or your parents will be on the internet. And then you better answer to them. That child has to live with that for the rest of his life. He's good at math, by the way. Isn't that good news? He's the first in class at science. Wonderful, isn't it? He's probably going for the Olympiad as well. He'll probably get a world prize in physics as well. I'm sure of it. This is why last week I appealed to you folks. The mission of the Sasana is what I need you all to stand up and rise to. The mission of the Sasana. These young children in our country, not just our country, but you know, start with our country. Let's start here, where we have the Buddha Sasana, where this is the land of the Buddha. Start at home, where you have two children, your son and your daughter, start with them. Do them justice. You brought them into this world, held them in your hands and looked at their faces and they said, Dua, I'm going to make you a princess. I'm going to make you the happiest woman alive. You promised them that. But if you haven't given them the elixir of Dhamma, how do you expect them to be happy? Because they're born with a pot that has a hole at the bottom. They're born with it. If they didn't have the hole, they wouldn't have been born in the first place. And what you do is try and fill it as much as you possibly can. Every day you try filling it. And you start with the small things and then you realize this is not enough because my child wants more. So you start filling the bigger things. And when that's not enough, you start filling it with the bigger, even bigger things and even bigger things and even bigger things. One day you'll give them the whole world and say, Dua, this is all I can afford. Here's the whole world. Can you be happy with this now? They'll be happy, yes, for 2 days. Because in 2 days' time, the whole world will leak from the bottom of that pot. And then they'll come back asking you, can I have some more? Then what do you have to give them? I speak to you so passionately about this because I care. I care about people who are nobody to me. You might wonder, what is Swami Mahasaya going on? What's his problem? He doesn't know us, he doesn't even, we don't even know each other by first names. Why does Swami Nasa care so much? Because I don't need to know you by your first names, because you are not who you think you are by your first names. You are not your first names. You are just chittas, suffering from raga, dvesha and moha, just like this chitta suffers from raga, dvesha and moha. Therefore you and I are family. Although you don't realize it yet. You are my long lost brother. And you, madam, my long lost sister. There's my father and there's my mother. We are all one family. I see that way. I can't help it. I didn't used to, but now I do and I can't help it. So then when I open my mouth, my heart starts to speak. What can I do? So please save yourselves. If not the Four Noble Truths, nothing else will save you. Save your children. Do what you can. Here's the treatment for cancer. Here's the medicine for cancer. Here's the medicine for everything. Here's the medicine for disappointments. Here's the medicine for frustrations. Here's the medicine for heart attacks. Here's the medicine for old age and disease and decay. Here's the medicine. Here's the medicine for every disease and every ailment that mankind has ever known. And those he will learn in the future as well. This is the medicine for all of it. Because the Buddha Sasana is where all suffering ends. You may not know what Parinibbana feels like right now. Don't worry about that. I'm setting for you a goal that you can see. ahead of you. Let's worry about the other goal after that, after you get there. So our goals are smart goals. Right? I'm not going to set you a goal that you can't even imagine, you can't even visualize, you can't even picture. My goal for you is this. This is the goal I would like to set you. Work towards a day where you don't suffer and you're there. You exist. You have everything around you. You have your family with you. You have your property with you. You have your cars, your vehicles, everything. You have your money. You have your everything. If you own half of the planet, then so be it. But you don't suffer. But right now, you can't go into a supermarket aisle and they can go into. Don't you feel that way? And you can't control yourself. Because desire arises in the mind, and now you no longer do what you want to do, but what the supermarket owner wants you to do. So your hard-earned cash, you spend there, and then you come back again and go work another day. Why? So you can earn enough money to keep him happy. You also work for the supermarket, don't you? That's what I'm saying, you know, become independent. Those things used to bother me, it doesn't anymore. You can't tempt me. Not with food, not with women, not with anything. You can't tempt me, I dare you. You can't tempt me. You can't tempt me out of my robe. No way. Unless my teacher tells me one day, to attain Nibbana, you have to disrobe. If he says that, I'm prepared to. Not otherwise. I'll be dead first. And I'm not here because this has given me an easy way out of life. Oh, no. Do you think this is easy? I only had 2 hours of sleep last night. Do you think this is easy? This is not easy. I don't want it to be easy. I want it to be easy on the other side of the fence, not here. Because I know when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. And it's getting tougher. And so be it. But I know deep inside, things that used to burn me from the inside, they don't do anymore. I don't succumb to lust and desire like I used to. I'm not saying that I'm completely and totally free from all of it. They're still there. I know. Still there. But I know I'm better than I used to be. And there is only one thing that made that change for me, and that is the Dhamma. Nothing else. It's not what I ate. It's not the robe that I put on my body. None of it. It's not where I live. It's not the monastery that did it to me. It is the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the elixir. It is the panacea. That is the remedy for all diseases. And I want you to experience it. And you can. You know, even young children, they come along. How wonderful. This is our future generation. Right? It is our young children who will take whoever we are to the future. And the fact that they're here, they're happy to come along with their parents a Sunday morning and be here. That's quite something, isn't it? Because they're yet to experience the world, whereas most of you will already have experienced the world. So you know that these paths lead nowhere. You've gone down that rabbit hole. You went down that rabbit hole and realized this is just a dead end. No happiness here. Turn around and walk back up. Went down another rabbit hole, no happiness here. Came back and walked down another one, and another one, and another one. No path leads to happiness, so you've come back. But these children, they haven't experienced all this. Now they don't have to. They don't have to make the same mistakes that you and I did. See how fortunate they are? Huh? Your children are so fortunate that they don't have to make the same mistakes that you did, right? You save them from them. You safeguard them. You protect them from the same mistakes that you made. In the same way, you know, young children, we can save them from the mistakes that you and I made. And it's the same I do for you right now. There were mistakes that I made in my life. And if you look at our understanding of the Dhamma, then I see you as young children. That is again not to offend anyone. Don't take any of these things as meaning to offend. It is only said with compassion. In those terms, I see young children. And if you will only listen to what I have to say, and will take it on board, and try to internalize it, and enact it, and practice it, you will be free, just as I am free today. I didn't come into robes after becoming a monk in my mind. I first became a monk in my mind, and then came into robes. So therefore, when I came into this, it was the obvious choice. In fact, it was not even a choice. That is why before any of you get any smart ideas, I need you to become a monk up here first. Monkhood is an attitude. It's the way, it's your perspective on things. You know, I can be driven around in a 4x4. I can be driven around in a luxurious vehicle. I can be flown around in an aircraft. I don't mind. My simplicity is not in the size of the vehicle I come or go in. It's not that. My simplicity is in the way that I'm happy. I don't need anything to be happy. I don't need much at all to be happy. That is my simplicity. So big or small, matters not to me. I can live in a mansion, or I can live under a shelter. Maybe a shelter of tree branches, that's fine. As long as the rain doesn't get me and the sun doesn't burn me, I'm okay. That's fine. But if you built a mansion or built a palace and said, Swaminarayan, you have to be there, that's fine. It's not a problem. So if you're already there, then that's fine as well. Isn't it? I come in a car, you come in a ship. So, what's the deal? Should you downsize? No. Remember, Buddhism is not to let go. I'll tell this to you from time to time, in case you hasten this letting go. Right? Buddhism is not about letting go. It's about realizing that there is nothing to let go. Did you catch that? Buddhism is not about letting go. It is about realizing that there is nothing that is yours to let go. Now, what do you have to let go? So the whole concept of letting go is a fallacy. According to Buddhist philosophy, there is nothing to let go. Tanha, or attachment, is a concoction of the mind when the mind feels, when the mind perceives a reality that it builds up by itself, a delusional reality. That is when the mind attaches. Not to real things, not to these things. The mind doesn't attach to these things. Heck, the mind just can't even see this. This is the eye that's seeing this. The mind is only seeing a perception of this. So the mind creates like a virtual reality, and in that virtual reality the mind has various dealings with. So when the mind attaches, it's not attaching to real things, although it seems like that. It's not. The mind is attaching to your version of the world, a version that it builds up itself. It's a fantasy. So all I have to do is ask you to wake up, open your eyes and realize that you're living in a fantasy. Once you realize that, you will realize that there is nothing to let go. That is the epiphany. So please, don't hasten to let go of anything, because otherwise you will regret. When one day you understand, oh, I shouldn't have let that go. It was not about letting go. Then it will be too late, because you will all have let go of it. Right? So you don't need to bring the lawyers in and start writing out all your property to, you know, every man and his dog. You don't need to do that. Whatever is yours, let it be. So be it. You know, sometimes people come to us and they want to become anagarikas, or, you know, they want to practice the and say, Swaminas, I want to give everything to the sasana. I say, oh, hold on. Let's not be hasty. Huh? I want to give my house to the sasana, I want to give my car to the sasana, I want to give my wife to... No. Let's not be hasty. Right? Sir, keep everything. Keep everything to your name. Right? And besides, when you say you want to become anagarik, you want to go on to become a monk, then relatives that you didn't know you even had. Huh? Relations and relatives that you didn't know that you even had We'll get news of this. And then like bees flying to a flower, they'll come looking for you to rekindle old relationships that haven't existed for the last three incarnations. They'll come and say, I was your brother two births ago. Can I have your house, please? It's a dog-eat-dog world, ladies and gentlemen. Keep your wits about you, right? So, you know, I encourage you to come along on this journey with me, and I'll take you as far as I can. I'll take you as far as I can, I promise you. For as long as you hold on to this robe, I say this robe because it's not me you should be holding on to. Okay, one day someone else will be sat here. So I'll take you as far as I can go. For as long as you do that, don't do anything hasty. Right? It's not about letting go. No, but keep everything you have to your name. All your land, all your property, all your wealth. If you own America, keep it. Don't give it away. Because one day when you realize what the Dhamma is, one day when you realize what Nibbana is, one day when you realize what your mission is, then you will see new reason, new purpose for all those things that you have and you've had. You will begin to realize, my house was a dwelling for sensual pleasures. Now my house can be a dwelling for the holy life. See, you still need the house. My car I used to use to go on trips, travel the country, travel the world, right, enjoy myself. Now I realize the Dhamma. My pot has been mended, so I no longer need to keep filling this. I am full, I am content. But now I can use this car for better things, for better purposes. But if you're given away your car, the moment you realize I want to one day become a monk, one day, someday, 10 years' time, then when the time comes you need it, it's not there now. Someone else is using it for nothing useful. Nothing meaningful. So I'm saying don't be hasty in letting go of anything. I've never asked you to let go of anything, so don't. Okay? The only three things I ask you to let go of are raga, dvesha and moha. Nothing more. And to let go of those three things, there is nothing you need to do. There's nothing you need to physically do. You just need to be here. So then really there's nothing for you to do. Actually, come to think of it. What are you doing actually? You've got nothing to do, have you? Just come here on a Sunday. But that is what you're doing. You're keeping yourself in the right environment. Like the jelly sets when you put it into the freezer. Or the fridge. Like ice sets. Right? Water becomes ice when you put it into the freezer. There is nothing the water has to do for that, right? There is nothing the jelly has to do to become jelly. Of the liquid to become jelly. You just need to put it in the fridge. Right? The environment does it. In the same way, this environment will do it for you. And that's not just me. It's your noble companions who are sat on either side. The people who, when you walk into this room, say, here, I've kept a seat for you. Take a seat. Those people. It's not just me who's doing all this. No man's an island. We're all in this together. Although you don't know it, you're all doing something for the other person. Collectively you're doing this. You know, your presence here itself is a vote of confidence, is it not? So when someone walks in through those doors for the first time and they see a few heads here, what are they going to think? Oh, this place must mean something. Whereas if there's only two of you, is this the right room? They might walk out. But don't bring yourself here for that. Only come here if you want to be here. But what I'm saying is your presence here means something. Your gentle words mean something. Your kindness means something. Because, you know, people will come here first because of who you are. Then they'll come and sit down. Because you invited them. They like you. That's why they come here. They may ask you, you know, what do you do on a Sunday morning? There's a sermon. Would you like to come with me? Yeah, I like you, so I'll come with you. That's why they'll come. They'll come here, they'll sit down, they'll listen to the sermon. Then, after that, whether you come or not, they'll come. But it is you who bring them here. You are the hook. I'm the fisherman. That's the way the sasana works. Here's the fisherman. And now I'm a hook. The fisherman. So we all do something. The people who set out the chairs, who clean this place, who turn on the lights, people who look out for your cars, and you know, there's someone looking after your children today so that you could get here today. Perhaps there's someone babysitting your children so that you could be here today. They're all doing something for you. Someone's fixing your lunch while you're here. They're doing something for you. Perhaps if you had to do it, you probably wouldn't be able to be here today. This is why gratitude is such a big part of all of this. Remember, we started with gratitude a long time ago, didn't we? That was setting the foundation, remember? As I said, you don't know what I have in store for you. That's the first thing I told you this morning. You have no idea what I have in store for you. Right? One talk at a time, I'm putting down the box, putting down the pieces, one step at a time. You don't even know it. Just let it happen. But don't take anything I say at face value. Come here open-minded. Analyze, contemplate, reflect. See if this agrees with your value system. See if this agrees with your virtues, with what you hold as dear. And ultimately, see if this helps you to free yourselves from raga, dvesha and moha. If that is happening for you, then something's happening here for you. If that is not happening for you, after a few weeks of you coming here, I tell you, try somewhere else. We don't have it in this shop. In this shop, maybe try next door. I'll be the first to say that. If this is not working for you, try somewhere else. But give it a while. Give it a while. Nothing happens overnight. Rome wasn't built in a day, you know. So you won't be either. So, Theruvan Saranai, what does it mean then? At least if we've discussed that today. I was going to talk to you about Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. Again! Next time, can you all sit and face the other direction? So I don't see your faces. I don't come with an agenda. As I turned the corner, I asked Swami Nohan, what did we talk about last week? He said, don't ask me about last week, ask the previous week. Last week was a complete, you know, off track. Right? And then the previous week was about the manifestations, right? And how suffering is a manifestation. And a few of you have come and asked me, Swami Nohan, can you continue on that, please? I said, yeah, I will. But fear not. Right? I'm laying down the bricks one at a time. This is an art. You just enjoy the picture. You enjoy what's happening to you. You enjoy the transformation that you're going through. That's what you have to enjoy. Like this is, you know, I'll cook the food. You have it. You eat it. You enjoy yourself. Enjoy the bliss. Enjoy the freedom. If you're leaving today sadder, worser than you came in, then, you know, today wasn't worthwhile. But if you're leaving today having got something into your lives, maybe, you know, something you decide to do a little bit differently to how you've always done it. Just one thing. But although it might seem like one thing, it'll make a big difference. It will. Consistency. Not variety. Consistency. Lastly, at the end of last week's talk, quite a few of you came up and asked me, Swami Nohan sir, we want to do something for the sasana. Right? I understand what your appeal is to do something for the mission of the sasana, and what should we do? Here's my answer. I am a Buddha Putra. I cannot ask you for anything. Because the Buddha has forbidden me from asking. I don't want to ask for anything. But what I want is this. I'm able to tell you about the things that the sasana is able to, through the sasana we are able to do today. So I brought along a short video of some of the things we do at the monastery. Have a look at it. See what things appeal to you. Because there may be some things that you like, some things that you're not so keen about. That's fine. See how you might be able to help and support some of those things. Remember, I'm not asking for your money. I'm not asking for anything actually. All I'm asking for you is to come here on a Sunday the morning. That's it. And 1, 2, 3. That's all I'm asking you for. Nothing else. Even in my lay life, one of the toughest things I had to do was sales, because I don't like asking. It's just not in my system. I don't like asking for things. I like to become deserving of things rather than asking for things. So that's been okay with me after becoming a monk, because I don't have to ask for anything now. But I can tell you what good we do. So if that appeals to you, if that interests you, and you know someone perhaps who might be able to help and support some of those things, then so be it. But if at the end of watching this you realize, yeah, good sadhana, then that is also very good. Because remember, when we do a merit transfer at the end, what do we say? Right? Those who have helped and supported us, including those who have passed on their well wishes. Because the whole purpose of all these folks is Nibbana. So therefore, if ever you come and ask me, Swaminathan, what do you want me to do? Please understand now, I'm not going to ask you to do anything. Because I don't want to ask you for something that you're not prepared to give. Or it might feel too much, or it might feel too heavy, or it might feel cumbersome. Because then your prasada chitta is lost. Then you don't feel good, you don't feel happy. And after that, I will fail because I will no longer be able to give you Nibbana. But because we've seen this in so many places out there, right? Someone told me once, there are two people in life that they hate to see. One is a traffic police officer, and the other one is a monk. Because every time you see one of these two people, they always ask for something. I'll tell you one thing, this monk will never ask you for anything. In fact, if you put too much into my alms bowl, I'll tell you all for that. So I want to show you a short video clip about some of the things we do at the monastery. If for nothing else, folks, I just want you to rejoice about the goodness that's happening in the world. And it's not just our monastery. There are plenty of places like that, I'm sure, where people do good things, great things, and not just in the name of Buddhism. You know, other religions, other faiths, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of good work going on out there. But I only, of course, know about what we do. And of course, my guarantee to you is this, all of these things that we do only in the name of Nibbana and nothing else. Because that is the only solace that I have come to realize, that we have all come to realize at our monastery. Nothing else makes us happier. Nibbanam paramang sukang, over and over and over again. No other thing can make us happy. Is it ready? Okay, so just have a look at this. And these are some of the things we do at the monastery. Rejoice, that's all I want you to do. Right? And if there are things that you think are areas in which you can support, then, again, we have a charity trust at the monastery so that the Swaminathans don't have to deal with any of the, you know, ins and goings and comings and goings. We don't deal with all that. So I don't have money on me or with me. Even if you offer a pirikar, I don't take it with me. All that goes to a charity trust which we have formed because the Swaminathans are not supposed to be dealing with money. When there's a lay community of people who are prepared to do that on our behalf in the name of merits, then why should I? So, where that is concerned, that is that. But you know, if there are people you know, perhaps you know, people who are able to facilitate some of these things, make them easier, more comfortable, then, of course, again, there's a charity trust and you can connect with them and do so. So, if you come and ask me, what can I do? My answer is, speak to the charity trust. So you might as well do that without even letting me know. If you want to know how to contact them, you can speak to Anagarika Mahathas, they'll have their details. Okay, so I'm not asking for anything from you. All I'm asking for you is to come here and sort yourself out. That's it. Right, let's take a few minutes for that. We managed to do all that in 6 years. That's because everyone who comes there comes with one purpose in mind. They're not all pulling in different directions. We all follow in the footsteps of one teacher. Unity is our strength. They all come with one purpose. That is healing themselves of the fire of raga, dvesha and moha and helping others do the same. Over the last 6 years, by this point, actually the figures on that are not quite accurate, because yesterday we had another ordination ceremony at the monastery. So 9 other young men joined our ranks, and now we rank 120, 124 in fact, Swami Mohan says. And you wonder, where are all these people coming from, falling out of the sky? They all listen to the teaching, especially young people. When they listen to it, they realize that the lives that they thought were going to give them happiness are not really going to. And then their path changes. Because, you know, everyone's here not to live somebody else's agenda, right? Everybody wishes to attain their happiness, their fulfillment, their success that they define for themselves. No one's here to live another person's agenda. And that applies to you as well. You're not here to live somebody else's agenda. You want to achieve happiness. So does everyone. So once they realize what true happiness is, then it's no question why paths change. But again, I say, you know, this is not... When the time will be right for you, it will be right for you. You will know it when it's right. So don't be at haste to let go of anything. Letting go is not what any of them did. What they realized and what they are continuing to realize is it is nothing they are holding on to. Okay? So what I wanted to do with that video was to stop all those questions that started coming to me from last week. What can I do? What can I do? So now you know what we do. So therefore, if there's in any way you wish to support any of those activities, then that's totally up to you. It is not a requirement, by the way, and I don't need to know who supports and who doesn't support either, because that is not what I'm here for. I'm here for something much bigger, much greater than that, and that is your salvation. In society and in life, I'm sure you're very accustomed to people coming up to you and asking you for things. Especially, you know, most of you will be very successful in life. You're probably very popular figures in society. So you're very used to people coming up to you and asking for things. So you're probably sick and tired of that. People coming and asking for things. Don't make a single donation. Because the sasana is not somewhere to donate to. Donation is what you give in the hope of helping them. Sasana is where we give in the hope of helping ourselves. That is what the sasana is. So, just in case you had any misunderstanding of why this was shown to you, I just want to clear that. This is not me asking for anything at all. I just want one thing. You get yourselves here and get your nibbana done. That's it. When the day comes you are no longer interested in that, let me know. I'll find something better to do on Sunday morning. Okay, right. I'm conscious of time. Let's take a moment to transfer the merits and bring today's sermon to a close. Next week, I promise to talk to you about Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankhara and Vinyana. Alright. Let us all take a moment then to rejoice and transfer the merits we have all acquired by coming along, inviting the Swami Nuhansi to deliver a sermon, listening to the sermon, as well as making available the facilities and inviting others to come along and join and rejoice in these merits, as well as listen to the Dhamma and work towards their salvation. Let us take a moment to transfer all those merits, first and foremost, reminding ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provided the four requisites for the Swaminarayan says, the Mahasangha, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees and our teachers, those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form by the power of these merits. May they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfilling and preserving the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And by the power of these merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have predeceased us, our ancestors, our forefathers, those who would have sacrificed blood, sweat and tears on our behalf, and it is because of their efforts today we enjoy the comforts that we do and the luxury in which we sit. We have gathered here today and listened to the Dhamma. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who would have lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe, as well as those who would have sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. This includes the armed forces as well as the police force. Let us also transfer these merits to those who would have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities, such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, blizzards, pandemics and the likes. May they all rejoice in these merits, reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and family to us, and acquaintances to us, those who would have seen us well and helped us and supported us. May they all rejoice in these merits. With an abundance of compassion and loving kindness and a sense of gratitude, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants amongst us. And by the power of these merits, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Teranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Members of the Mahasangha will now transfer the blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatnva, dvesha ginnen midatnva, moha ginnen midatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, Yogini Niveva Mohagini Niveva Nivansapalabeva
துன்றுவான்கே சூசி அனந்த மகாகுணபெலன் சிறுலோக சீலு சத்தயோம நிபான பரமசுகேன் சுகித தரவெத்வா சாது சாது சாது.